What was the most transformative age in human history? There's a case to be made that it wasn't some era from our deep past, but a fairly recent stretch of time, the 5 decades or so following World War II. In the new book, The Age of Interconnection, a global history of the second half of the 20th century, Jonathan Sperber does a deep analysis of an age that saw massive changes in politics, culture, and technology, from the nuclear bomb to the fall of the Twin Towers. Jonathan is an emeritus professor of history at the University of Missouri, and his previous book, Karl Marx, A 19th Century Life, was a New York Times bestseller and a finalist for the 2014 Pulitzer Prize in Biography. Here's Jonathan to share 5 of his big ideas.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Sperber, and I have the rather overwrought title of Curator's Distinguished Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Missouri. You might know one of my previous books, Karl Marx, A 19th Century Life, which was a finalist for the 2014 Pulitzer Prize in Biography, or perhaps you've seen the interview about it I did with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. I'm here to talk about my new book, The Age of Interconnection, A Global History of the Second Half of the 20th Century. The talk will be divided into 5 main points or insights. First, there will be a justification, the reason for tackling such a large-scale and ambitious project. Then there will be accounts of each of the book's 2 main themes. The final points will demonstrate how these themes provide insights into 2 characteristic, but not often considered elements of the history of the era: human interaction with the environment, and the 3 worldwide waves of utopian aspirations, each connected to one of the fateful years of the period, 1945, 1968, and 1989. Insight number 1. The second half of the 20th century, or to put it another way, the years between VJ Day in 1945 and 9/11 in 2001, contained remarkable and spectacular developments. Humans walking on the moon, the constant threat of a thermonuclear war that would destroy all life on Earth, the elimination of diseases such as smallpox that had been a millennia-long scourge on humanity, or the end to the largest colonial empires in human history, to name just a few. Maybe the impact of these events is a little too strong and the past too recent because so many historians' accounts amount to a reiteration of old newspaper headlines, talking about one crisis after another, or gee whiz descriptions of scientific and technological marvels. The main themes, the structuring elements, the changes in the periodization of an era, usually historians' strong points, are missing. Pundits rush in where historians fear to tread, and they have a variety of slogans to characterize the era, including globalization, the world is flat, or the singularity. This approach lacks historical context, flattens out the past, and fails to make distinctions between the past, even the recent past, and the present. The point of my book is to analyze the recent past, not to reiterate the headlines, but to look at the structures and developments that shaped the headlines. This way of proceeding has the 2 great virtues of historical analysis that enable it to illuminate the present, tracing how the past differs from the present, and also how the present developed out of the past. Insight number 2. One main theme I use to structure my analysis and narrative of the second half of the 20th century is global interconnections, the increasing extent to which individuals, ideas, cultural practices, goods, and capital crossed boundaries of sovereign states, continents, and oceans, creating globally encompassing systems, a world not just of connection, but of interconnection. In contrast to naive ideas about globalization, this process of creating an interconnected world was not continuous or consistent. Common developments across the globe could play out very differently in countries with different political systems, social structures, or states of economic development, something that became apparent during the COVID pandemic, but which had many precursors. Global interconnections in some areas could lead to their rejection in others. The enormous increases in worldwide trade, financial transactions, and cross-border investments have not resulted in cosmopolitan attitudes, but in xenophobic nationalism and intolerant forms of religion. Insight number 3. The second main theme of the book is the impact of the Age of Total War, the years 1914-45, on the second half of the 20th century. Major features of international relations during that time, such as the Cold War or the so-called North-South conflict, were directly shaped by the course and outcome of the Second World War. While the impact of the Age of Total War was greatest in the decades immediately after 1945, it could extend until the end of the century. the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the communist Eastern Bloc, and the unification of the two German states in 1989-90 marked the end of the Cold War, but they were also the final legal end of the Second World War as well. The impact of the Age of Total War was extraordinarily widespread. Central elements of post-1945 technology, jet aircraft, rockets, nuclear power and nuclear weapons, antibiotics, television, solid-state circuits, were products of the Age of Total War, particularly of the Second World War, an immense hothouse of technological progress. One more way we can see the impact of the Age of Total War is in the division of the second half of the 20th century into specific periods. A post-war era from 1945 to the early 1960s, when social, economic, political, demographic, and diplomatic structures largely derived from the era of total war, an age of upheaval in the 1960s and 1970s when those structures were destroyed, and the final two decades of the century, the late millennium era, as I call the years 1980 to 2001, when the contours of the contemporary world came into existence. Insight number four. Let's take a look at how this combination of growing global interconnection and the heritage of the Age of Total War played out in considering human interaction with the environment. The post-war era saw the fastest rates of both economic and population growth worldwide of any time in human history, before or since. Long-standing past practices to deal with the pollution resulting from expanding industrial and agricultural production, especially diluting emissions in large bodies of water and in the atmosphere, reached their physical limits. The environmental impacts of both older sources of pollution, coal smoke or leaded gasoline, as well as newer ones, products of the Second World War, including DDT or radioactive fallout from nuclear weapons tests, were increasingly apparent. Understanding of this condition and attempts to deal with it developed slowly and gradually, getting a large charge from the oppositional mass movements and the cultural and political changes of the 1960s. Most thinking about human impact on the biosphere in this period followed along the line set out by Thomas Malthus and his predictions of population invariably outstripping food supply. Widespread apprehension of imminent mass starvation was characteristic of the emergent concern about the environment in the 1950s and 1960s. The predicted famines never came to pass, in spite of the very rapid pace of population increase, as a result of the Green Revolution, the spread of the agricultural technology of hybridizing grains, yet another product of the Age of Total War, around the world. Norman Borlaug, the Iowa biologist who was central to that effort, is the most important person you haven't heard of in the second half of the 20th century. In the 1970s, interest in environmental protection increased around the world. The number of national environmental agencies or government ministries going from about 20 in 1970 to some 180 a decade later. Understanding of human impact on the environment was shaped by a revised version of Malthus's argument, articulated in the famous 1972 Club of Rome report, The Limits to Growth, that the combination of population growth and economic growth was outstripping all resources, not just foodstuffs. The first oil price shock of 1973 and the gasoline shortages stemming from it seemed to underscore the argument. A crucial resource was already running out. In the end, the oil price shocks, while a distinct turning point for the global economy, were not a signal of a declining supply of natural resources. New discoveries of oil and other minerals and more efficient use of available resources have, at least, raised questions about the gloomy view of the future in the Club of Rome report. While there was modest progress in environmental remediation, including the end of leaded gasoline, improved water purity, and declines in atmospheric sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides, environmental degradation in the communist countries of the Eastern Bloc continued and played a distinct role in communism's end in Eastern Europe during 1989-91. In the late millennium era, new environmental issues appeared, particularly those connected with growing atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases and the use of chemicals that destroyed the atmosphere's ozone layer. Both of these issues were different from previous forms of environmental impact of human activity, not immediately perceptible as with smog in the air or filthy streams. Emissions impact was globalized, crossing the borders of sovereign states, not concentrated in the vicinity where they originated. They were also relatively recent. Large-scale production of chemicals harming the ozone layer only began in the 1960s, and in 1960, carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere were just 5% above pre-industrial levels. coming to broader public attention at the same time, these two new forms of human impact on the environment had very different resolutions. The Montreal Accord of 1987 began the global elimination of chemicals harmful to the ozone layer. Successfully implemented and repeatedly reinforced, with more chemicals added to the banned list and more countries joining the prohibitions, the result has been the ozone layer's gradual recuperation. The 1997 Kyoto Protocol, designed to limit greenhouse gas emissions, has been a complete failure. CO2 emissions and global temperatures have risen rapidly and substantially since then. In contrast to the original ideas of Thomas Malthus and their revisions in the Club of Rome report, these represent a new form of human impact on the environment. The way that emissions stemming from rising population and economic growth can undermine the bases in the biosphere for human economy and society, an issue emerging in the late millennium era of the second half of the 20th century, and one with which the world is grappling today. Insight number five. Our last point concerns the three crucial years and the three great worldwide waves of utopian aspirations. The Second World War was the greatest war in human history, with the most loss of life, massive political and socioeconomic upheaval around the world, and with the use of unprecedented and terrifying weaponry. These were apocalyptic circumstances, and the war ended on a wave of apocalyptic expectations, fears of a nuclear war, hopes of a new, just, and emancipatory world. These hopes were found among adherents of resistance to Nazi occupation, who connected liberation from Nazi rule with social and political revolution, among anti-imperialists in Africa and Asia, who saw liberation from colonial rule as leading to a new, better stage in human history, and almost everywhere, in the great hopes for global governance, preserving the peace and expanding human rights, embodied in the newly formed United Nations. The post-war era saw the apocalypse that denied. Post-war Europe brought not utopias, but consumer societies or bureaucratic Stalinist domination. Newly independent countries liberated from imperialist rule were not paragons of virtue, but just more nation-states. The UN was hamstrung by the Cold War and by refusal of the powers, great and small, to give up any of their sovereign authority. A second wave of utopian aspirations was associated with the mass movements of the 1960s. Often seen as embodied in affluent young people in the world's wealthy countries, these mass movements were actually worldwide, not just Berkeley, Paris, West Berlin, or New York, but also Prague, Warsaw, Mexico City, Montevideo, Dakar, Shanghai, and Dhaka, and not only educated and affluent young people, but impoverished members of racial minorities and older salaried employees, blue-collar workers, and peasants as well. Unlike the post-1945 utopian aspirations emerging from total war and socioeconomic crisis, these mass movements came out of decades of prosperity and economic growth. Demands for greater participation in universities, industrial enterprises, or government were characteristic and presupposed the continuation of that post-war prosperity. Alongside gigantic mass movements such as the events of May, the giant French strike wave of May 1968, or the Cultural Revolution in China, there was a drumbeat of demonstrations, confrontations, and occupations brought to global public attention through the then-new medium of television. In the end, the utopian aspirations faltered, defeated by government repression, nationalist hostilities, political co-optation, and by the end of post-war prosperity. 1970s and 1980s movements in favor of women's rights, environmental protection, and human rights, though, emerged from this matrix of 1960s utopian aspirations and were shaped by them. The third wave of utopian aspirations was connected to the mass movements of 1989 in opposition to communist rule in Eurasia. The end of communism came increasingly to be understood as legitimating its Cold War rival capitalism in its particularly militant 1980s form as it had developed from the extreme libertarian ideas of University of Chicago economist Milton Friedman and practiced by the right-wing governments of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. The post-Cold War future would unleash markets worldwide through privatization and deregulation. The United States would create and dominate, as U.S. President George H.W. Bush said, a new world order. Unlike the left-wing utopian aspirations of 1945 and 1968, post-1989 utopias were conservative, promoted by pundits, think tankers, bankers, and economists. Privatization and deregulation brought not prosperity to post-communist Eastern Europe, but social chaos, organized criminality, and economic decline. unleashed global financial markets, produced financial crises in Mexico, East Asia, and Russia between 1994 and 1998, and then across the world in 2008. Opposition to a U.S. hegemony ensuring a world of deregulated markets increased, first among Islamists, and then among authoritarian nationalists who rejected a U.S.-led multilateral order. Like the two previous waves of utopian aspirations, this one proved to be, well, utopian. If this talk has interested you and you would like to see how the themes of global interconnection and the impact of the age of total war can be applied to the post-1945 history of economic institutions, migration, international relations, spaceflight, social structures, labor, gender orders, and the position of women in society and politics, organized religion, the idea of progress or the practice of mass murder, to name other topics taken up in the age of interconnection, then you might consider purchasing the book with the information provided on the next Big Idea Book Club website. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Jonathan. That was Jonathan Sperber with five big ideas from The Age of Interconnection, a global history of the second half of the 20th century. Also, have a listen to our book bite for The Wires of War, Technology and the Global Struggle for Power by Jacob Helberg. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.